All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. It's great to have everyone here this morning. Okay, so today's topic is heaven. What is the Jewish understanding of heaven? What does Kabbalah say about heaven, etc.? There are so many jokes about heaven and hell. It's really, I guess it's no laughing matter, but it kind of is a laughing matter. So the story goes that Bill Gates passes away. I think some of you know this. Bill Gates, not that he passed away, he's still alive, but the joke about him passing away. So he passes away, and they take him up. They take him up to the great pearly gates, and they give him a choice. They say, you know what? You've done a lot of charity, done a lot of charitable giving. You have a fantastic foundation. You're a wonderful man. So you have a choice. You can go wherever you want. Heaven or hell? So he says, why would I want to go to hell? So they say, yeah, we just like to give options. So wherever you want to go. He says, you know what? Let me check out hell first. So they get into the elevator and they press the down button. It's the red, you know, you ever see that red button in the elevator? So they also have one, but it's not like the emergency. It's going down. And they go down and Bill Gates, the doors open. Bill Gates steps out and he sees it's beautiful. It's like a sandy beach with palm trees and it's tremendous. It's beautiful. It's fabulous. Okay. He gets back in the elevator. They go up to heaven. Get out to heaven. He sees, you know, he sees clouds and fluffy angels with wings and it's also nice. But he says to the person, you know, managing, the angel managing the elevator, he says, you know what, actually, hell looked kind of a little bit more exciting than heaven. I think I'll go down there. So he says, you sure? He says, yeah, it's okay, no problem. So they take him back down. He gets out. And they send him in there. A few minutes later, you hear him screaming. Angel says, what's wrong? What's going on? He's like, it's nothing like I saw before. There's no beach, there's no sand, there's only fire and coals and all this, you know, red stuff. What's going on? He said, oh, we must have had the screensaver on. All right. You know, window screensaver? Yes. Had to be there. All right, so today we talk about what do we really believe about heaven and hell. No, heaven is not a place with fluffy clouds. And hell is not a place with pitchforks and, you know, whatever, and devils and whatnot. Let's talk about what the Jewish perspective on heaven and hell is. So, one thing we have to keep in mind is that anytime we try to picture spiritual realities by using physical images, we're going to be necessarily incorrect. So that's statement number one. If you're trying to picture a spiritual state of being by using physical imagery in your mind or physical descriptions, you're already out of the game. It's already incorrect. Because what we're doing is then we're applying physical constraints on realms that are not at all in that type of reality. It's not a physical reality. No, heaven doesn't have a massive slide that's really fun. I don't know why, if anybody thought that, but no, there's no slide. There are no physical clouds. The angels don't have physical wings, right? None of those, good morning, none of those physical descriptions hold true with regards to heaven. And the same thing is true with what in Judaism is called Gehinnom. There are no physical elements there that parallel our physical universe. And even if we encounter texts, Jewish texts, that may seem to portray heaven or Gehinnom, it using physical terminology, you should know that all that terminology is, as is known classically in Jewish thought, all of it is anthropomorphic terminology that is not meant to be taken literally. It's language that's used so that we can have some sort of understanding. Here you go. Some sort of, maybe two, but if there's the next one, just keep it. So, some sort of understanding of what it's like, but not in a literal sense. So for example, somebody, listen, this is not a good thing, but it's a thing. Why do I say it's not a good thing? It's not a good thing because, you know, we're told not to, in Torah, we're told not to gossip. Okay, so that's caveat number one. However, sometimes it happens that a person overhears a good piece of gossip, right? We shouldn't be doing it, we shouldn't be saying it or listening to it, fine. But what do you call a really good piece of gossip? What adjective do we use sometimes? A really good piece of gossip?
Juicy.
I want to ask you a question. A juicy piece of gossip, what? It's an actual tangible item that has like drips of juice and moisture coming out of it? Come on. Of course not. So why do we call it juicy? It's not meant literally, it's meant figuratively. You're taking something that exists in a tangible space and moving it to apply it to the intangible space, right? You're taking a description such as juicy, which works on, I don't know, a steak or whatever it is, right? Or whatever it is that's juicy. You take, and by the way, you should know, I remember hearing this or reading about this, food commercials. They always make the food look juicy, whether it's strawberries or tomatoes, right? There's always, if there's moisture involved, if there are like droplets of water on it, oh, it looks that much more tasty. Yeah, a dried out piece of food is not gonna, yeah, you're not gonna like attract. But if it has moisture on it, if it has water droplets, it looks exciting. That's fresh. The way it, huh?
Fresh.
It looks fresh, it looks exciting. By the way, in Kabbalah it says, in the book of Tanya famously he quotes, the beginning, first book of Tanya, end of the first chapter, he says that water, what is, he says that the element of water, the four elements, there's fire, water, wind, and earth. The element of water also, it does many things, but one of the negative things that it does is water cultivates all sorts of pleasure. Anything that is pleasurable, mainly, I think, the discussion about food. So it's always nurtured by water. But what's interesting is that pleasure is enhanced. Like, when do you, the food looks better when it has the water droplets on it, right? They cut a fresh tomato. If it has, like, water droplets on it and, like, splashing even, oh, it's even that much more dramatic and more delicious. Fine. The point is that the juicy piece of gossip did not have water on it, did not have moisture on it. It didn't have that. But we call it juicy because, like the fresh fruit that is juicy and ripe and delicious and tasty, so we might say, God forbid, that a piece of gossip is also tasty and fresh, hot off the press, right? Breaking news and enjoyable to listen to. We might say that. We shouldn't say that. We might say that. That's what we define as, that's what we call a juicy piece of gossip. Now again, it's not literally juicy. But we apply a term that has a tangible meaning to a concept that is an intangible concept. So the same thing is true in Jewish texts when you encounter discussions that seem to portray the spiritual realm in physical terminology, you should know. It's not meant to be taken in a literal sense. It's meant to be understood in a figurative sense. It's just giving us some sort of measure of understanding to recognize some of the natures of the spiritual property that apply to it. So, for example, if we say that angels have wings, right? What does it mean? Well, what do wings do for birds? Fly and soar and elevate. Well, when it comes to angels, if we say that angels have wings, what does it mean? Not that they have, you know, appendages on their bodies. They don't have bodies. Angels don't have bodies. So what is it? It's a concept of growth and spiritual elevation. Just like birds with wings fly, angels with wings, non-literal wings, also have the ability to ascend. An ascent in the spiritual realm doesn't mean from physical, from below to above in a physical sense. But what it means is, of course, is a spiritual ascent, getting closer and closer to God. So again, on every single level. Angels with wings ascending higher is not meant to be taken literally. It's not actual wings. And the higher is not physically higher. It's spiritually higher. Like I've said many times, where are the angels? Where are the souls? We say up in heaven. Where's heaven? Is it up? Why is heaven up? Why is it up? Why? Because the sky is up? The sky is not heaven. The clouds? Why is that heaven? Why is it up? It's not up. It's right here. You and I can't see it. Fine. Our vision is limited. Higher doesn't mean physically higher. It means closer. Higher means a greater awareness. The way Kabbalah defines high and low in the spiritual context is not physically, geographically higher or lower. It's not like if you sleep on a bunk bed, you're closer to God on the top of a bunk bed, right? It's like, I want the top bunk. Why? Now I'm closer to God, closer to heaven. It's not how it works. It's not how it works. Higher and lower means that you have a greater understanding or a less of understanding, or a greater perception or less perception. That's what higher or lower is. Higher and lower in the spiritual realms mean which, how closely do you identify with self, lower, or how closely do you identify with the source, higher. So the angels are higher than you and I, at least on an external level, without getting into the truth of the power of our souls, okay? But angels are apparently higher than human beings. Why? Because they have a greater recognition of God on the day-to-day basis than we do. We wake up in the morning and we think about self and we take care of self, and maybe we squeeze in a few minutes of thinking about God and doing something for God, you know, throughout our day. Maybe more than a few minutes, but most of the day is spent on us and our things. Whereas angels are always focused on God. So they're higher, not physically higher. They're closer to truth than we are. And closer to truth, we call it higher. It's not physically higher. Make sense? It's so interesting because almost all of the terminology that we use in talking about spiritual things, almost all of it is not meant to be taken literally. So why do we use it? Why do we use that language? Come up with another language, right? Good luck. What are you going to say? You're going to make up words? Angels are, make up a new term, and then someone will say, raise a hand, what does that mean? I don't know. We use terminology, language that we can relate to. Torah speaks, Kabbalah speaks in language that you and I can relate to. Using language that represents a concept in the physical realm that we're meant to kind of strip from the physical attachment to move to a more conceptual place and then apply to the spiritual realm. That's our job. Our job is to move it out of the literal and into what it really means. And that's what Kabbalah teaches us. That's why the Talmud says not to study the first chapter of Ezekiel. And now you're thinking, wow, what does that say? You know what it says? It talks about angels with wings and angels with other sorts of descriptions. It talks about God's chariot, and it talks about God in the form of a man sitting on a throne on top of the chariot. And that's what the Talmud says, don't study it. Because to the untrained student, you read that, oh wow, this is God? This is God's divine chariot? This is what's going on? Sounds very physical, very material. And it does. And that's why, unless you know how to study it, our sages tell us that it's probably not a good idea to dabble in it. Unless you have a guide, unless you have some sort of instruction, it's probably not within our best interest to go ahead and get involved in it, because the danger is that we might take it literally. And taking it literally is to miss the point. God is not a man sitting on a throne, and the throne is not a chair, and the angels don't have wings, and the chariot doesn't have wheels, right? None of that is true in a literal sense. So what does it mean? What does the symbolism mean? Okay, that's the right question to ask. Right? The question to ask is, what does it mean? Not, wow, I didn't know God was a man or God had a chariot that rolled. That's not the right question. That's missing, right? The right question is, what does it really mean? Oh, so for that, we study Kabbalah. And either we get there or we don't get there, but we study it. But it certainly doesn't mean what it appears to mean in a literal sense. It's certainly not the meaning of it. So when it comes to heaven and hell, or heaven and Gehinnom, so we need to explain what that is in a Kabbalistic way of understanding. I once heard a metaphor. Heaven and hell are the same thing. Somebody once said, you walk in, it's a big ballroom. Again, not to be taken literally. You walk in, it's a big ballroom with tables, long tables, you know, going down. And another row of tables, another row of tables. People are sitting next to each other. And the meal is set lavishly. But everyone's arms are locked. There's a brace on it, and they're all locked at arm's distance. And they have utensils, but you can't feed yourself, right? Unless this bends. Unless your elbow bends, you can't feed yourself. So the table is set with all this lavish food. But the arms, everyone's arms are locked. And the cutlery is accessible, but you can't feed yourself. So in heaven, everyone's feeding each other. And in hell, everyone's just starving because they won't feed anybody else. That's a joke that I don't know if it's a joke, but it's a concept, right? So what is heaven and what is hell or Gehinnom in Jewish understanding? So famously, and some of you may know this, but I think it bears repeating, especially as today we focus on a very interesting perspective of heaven. So let's start with going down, not literally, right? But the elevator, right? Going down to the floor of doom, right? So what is hell? What is Gehinnom? All right. So Gehinnom is less punishment and more cleansing. Let's explain. A soul spends time in a body on earth. Now souls emanate from God. Now everything comes from God, right? Everything. Our text for sure certainly tells us that everything that exists is coming from God. So even the stone that seems to be on its own, it has a soul and it's powered by God. Fabulous. But the soul, a human soul, is unique because a human soul, even in its physical incarnation, and I don't mean that it is a physical being, but I mean its visit to a physical world, even as it's here in this state, a soul retains its spiritual identity and its consciousness. Whereas a stone, as far as we know, doesn't necessarily retain that consciousness. A stone, we don't believe, is aware of the fact of that it's a creation of God. Human beings also very often aren't conscious and aware of that, although that's the truth. But the soul is always aware of it. When I say human beings, I mean the body part of the human being is not aware of it, but the soul is aware of it. So souls are very unique in that they come from God and they retain their awareness of their source. But souls spend time in a body. And spending 80, 90, 100, 110, 120 years in a body does something to the soul. And the soul begins to identify a little bit with itself as it connects with the body, right? In other words, it starts to see itself a little bit like an entity that almost needs or belongs with the body as well. And so, whereas before birth, the soul protests and says, I don't want to go down into a physical body. I'm a soul. I'm a pure divine spirit. I don't want to go down into a body. At the end of a person's lifetime, the soul again protests not wanting to leave that same body that it didn't want to come down to in the first place. In the language of the Mishnah, and this is not Kabbalah, this is the Mishnah, Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers. It says, Bal karchecha techai, against your will, you live. Val karchecha temes, and against your will, you die. Life, birth, was against the will of the soul, and death is also against the will of the soul. The soul didn't want to come down into a body, and once it came down, doesn't want to leave a body. Because at the end of the day, after decades of attachment to a body, the soul becomes somewhat, I don't know, sympathetic, empathetic. It can relate to the body and understands the body, and it identifies somewhat with the body. And so to lose that attachment is painful for the soul. Now, depending on how materialistic a person was or is, the soul will have a harder time letting it go. So if a person lives a very materialistic life, then the soul will be trained more and more toward materialism, and the soul will have a harder time leaving, uncoupling with the body, because that's all it's known for the last X number of decades. So we'll have a harder time letting it go and saying goodbye to that physical experience. On the other hand, if a person lives a more spiritual existence, a more spiritual life, if a person's life is filled with good deeds and higher living and selfless living, right? Filled with things that are more about soul and less about body. When it comes time for the soul to leave the body, although the soul will miss the opportunity to do physical good deeds, it won't miss all of the other physical accoutrements that came along with it, because it was never about that in the first place. It won't miss, I don't know, the sushi. Why? I'm a big sushi fan. But it won't miss the sushi if it wasn't trained to be into sushi, because that was never its thing. And if it's about getting close to God, perfect. You're about to get closer than you've been in a long time. Or you're about to become more aware of truth in an obvious way than you've been in a long time. All the stuff that you've been discovering, you're going to see it now, which we'll get to in a moment when we talk about heaven. So what is hell? What is purgatory? What is Gehinnom? You know, purgatory is a better English word for Gehinnom, the Jewish understanding of hell. Purgatory comes from the word purge. What does purge mean? To get rid of. To divest, to get rid of. In essence, purgatory, Gehinnom, is the process by which a soul sheds its material identity and resumes its holy and entirely spiritual identity. The soul is an entirely spiritual being. But spending time with a body, it somehow takes on, it takes on somewhat an identity of soul and body. Right? You take on an identity. It's like a person who has a job, and then one day they leave their job. And let's say it's on good terms. Let's say they retire. But they may wake up the next morning and ask the question, well, who am I? I've identified with this job for so long. I don't have the job anymore. Who and what am I? And the answer is, well, you're the same person you were. You're just not doing this thing, but you're the same person you were. But why might it feel like that? Because the person, having done something consistently for so long, a person starts identifying with that thing that they're doing, even though that's not really them. But you may start identifying with that thing. And so it's no different for the soul. The soul is not a body. The soul is not a physical being. But spending so much time with the body and doing so many body-oriented things, look, wherever the body goes, the soul goes. It's not like we leave our soul behind. We take our soul wherever we go. That's why Tanya says, be careful where you take yourself. Because the soul is a piece of God. So you're taking your soul, which is a piece of God, wherever you go. The example that's used in Kabbalah is sometimes some things that we're doing, it's like taking, imagine a king, taking the head of the king and dunking it into a pile of waste and filth. That's not nice. So be careful where we take our souls, right? That's the implication. But after the lifespan of a human being, at the end of the day, pretty much whoever it is, there's some sort of material attachment or identification. Again, if you've done a job for a certain amount of time and you're not doing it anymore, on some level, you're going to feel like, wow, you know, who am I? Where am I? Something's missing because I'm no longer doing this thing. You feel something, a piece of your identity, at least for a short term, you feel like it's been ripped away or whatever, or it's missing. The same thing is true with the soul. The soul identifies with the body. And as nice as that might sound, it's not healthy for the soul, for its long-term benefit. Why? Because ultimately the soul is meant to resume a holy spiritual identity and resume an awareness of God in a pure and an incredible sense. And if it's still holding on to, you know, the time that we, you know, got into the Corvette and went on, give me a nice route for a Corvette. Route 66, there you go. Classic Route 66. Man, those were good times, right? If the soul is still thinking that, it's not able to bask in its current state. It's like the Baal Shem Tov told the story, and it's, I don't think it's a literal story, but it's more of trying to bring out this point of a fellow, of a wagon driver, who was not a nice person. He was a wagon driver, but he wasn't the most ethical and honest individual. But one time, as he was doing his thing, riding his horse and buggy, this wagon driver encountered a person who was stuck on the side of the road and in danger, life and death danger, and he saved this person's life. And we know in Judaism, if you save a life, it's like you saved an entire world, and that's a big deal. And so when he passes away, they tell him, look, you did a lot of stuff that wasn't so cool, but you did save a life. And because you saved a life, there's a lot of reward for you. So, you get to choose whatever you want. In fact, we'll let you create your own heaven. And he says, you know what I want? Here's what I want for my heaven. I want a road that's very smooth, a beautifully paved road, and the finest horses, and a wagon with smooth and greased wheels, and a good whip, right? Well, that's what he said. I didn't say it. I'm just telling you the story. I'm not... Okay, maybe a megaphone. Please go faster. I don't know. And a comfortable seat. And that's what my heaven should be. And so the Baal Shem Tov said, again, I don't know if it was literal, maybe tongue-in-cheek, that for all eternity, this fellow is on his horse, is on his carriage, saying, what do you say to a horse when you're on a carriage? Giddy up! Giddy up! Or whatever, without the whip. All right. Giddy up, and the horses are going on this beautifully smooth road for all eternity. And this is his conception of heaven, so he got what he wanted. The point is, God forbid we should get such a heaven, right? A material, talk about being stuck in material ways of thinking and applying it to the spiritual, right? What's heaven? A place with lots of Bitcoin, lots of candy, lots of... Right, you tell children when Mashiach comes, what's going to happen? Candy is going to grow on trees. Oh, Mashiach is amazing. Definitely want Mashiach. Why? Candy will grow on the trees. Is that it? Candy will grow on trees? I don't think that's what it's going to be. But it means that all of the wonderful things will be accessible. And what will be wonderful then? Spiritual things. So the same thing is true for the soul. It's in the soul's best interest to be purged and released and cleansed from the material attachment that it's picked up over the years, during its time with the body. So as the soul is with the body, it suddenly likes this material pleasure and that physical thing and that vacation and that reality and that house and that car and that bed. And it likes all these things. And the soul also gains some sort of, at least... a sense of comfort or identification with it, if not a certain sense of pleasure as well. Certainly the lower dimensions of the soul gain a certain type of pleasure from the material as well. And so the first step after a person passes away is purgatory, where the soul gets purged from the physical identification. And it resumes a holy spiritual state. And so now it can connect with what it needs to connect to. Instead of getting stuck on the road with the horse and wagon for all eternity, the soul has a chance to move on to a much more enlightened state of being. So how long is this process? So Jewish thought teaches us that maximum cleansing time is 12 months for the ones that really need a deep clean, right? You know how your washing machine has different cycles? There's like light soil, what do they call it? Soil? Lightly soil, light soil, medium, or heavy. And then they ask you, do you want an extra rinse? Pre-rinse, right? If you hit all the buttons, right, it's upwards of like it's pushing 2 hours at some point. Or you can go the quick and easy, you know, 25 minute, 30 minute, you know, no big deal. I just need to, you know, kind of refresh here. The same thing, exactly the same, obviously I'm kidding, but in a similar fashion, it is with the souls. So really heavily, I don't want to say soiled souls, God forbid to call them soiled, but souls that need more purging, let's say that, souls that need more purging, a more serious process, require 12 months. Others, 11 months or less, which is why, when we say Kaddish, the memorial prayer for a loved one, we only say it for 11 months and a day. Because we don't want to assume that our loved ones needed the full 12 months. Ah, Uncle Jimmy, he need. No, we never want to say, God forbid. Huh? Yeah. Yeah, dear. No, God forbid. We never want to assume that someone needed the full-on span for the cleansing process. The Kaddish helps the soul through that process. And understand this. As a soul goes through this very necessary process, and a process that's healthy for the soul, it's very healthy for the soul to kind of deprogram itself from its material attachment. It's good for the soul. But as it goes through that process, understand that it is not always comfortable. It's a little bit painful. It's painful to let go. It's not easy to let go. A person who, as I mentioned before, I gave the example, a person who, you know, retires and leaves the job, but was fond of the job. It's not an easy process. Person may wake up, you know, on some days and miss it and feel sad. It's no different whether we're talking about a job or a relationship or a loved one who's passed on, and talking about the person who's still remaining on this physical earth. It's not easy, huh?
And it's scary.
Some
colleagues been, you know, very invested and kids don't want to leave for that reason.
Yeah.
Like, what am I going to do?
What will I be? What will I do? And so to let go of an identity is not always easy. It's a painful process, somewhat painful process. Again, Kabbalah teaches, the more we identified physically with the body on earth, the harder and more difficult the process will be. So the good advice that Kabbalah teaches is, don't get so attached. We're all attached. You cannot go through life without physical attachment. The soul is in the body. It walks around, right? It moves with us. It's like in the language of Kabbalah, using a metaphor, if you're in a space that has an aroma and you walk out of that place, you're going to carry the aroma with you, right? I'll give you a positive example and a negative example. Right? You walk into a perfume shop, right? Place where they're making scents, and you walk in and you spend some time there, you walk out, you know, you still have the nice scents on your clothing. On the other hand, if you walk into a place that doesn't smell so nice, for example, what's an example? The classic example in Jewish understanding is a tannery. I've never been to a tannery, but apparently it's the worst, huh? Yeah. Yeah. So, in fact, in Jewish law, it says not to put a tannery inside the city where people live. It has to be Jewish city planning says it's got to be a little bit outside. But yeah, so like if you walk in, or like a fish store or whatever it is, you walk into a place that smells, you walk out, you might carry the odor with you. So no matter what, a soul living in residing in a body, after it departs from the body and separates from the body, after it decouples, it's going to carry some aroma, whether it's something, some aroma, some scent from the body. But again, the more materialistic we are, the more physically attached we are, then the soul is going to have a little bit of a more involved experience in trying to get rid of that or divest itself of that attachment. Whereas if we're less attached, the process is a little bit easier. So the good advice is we should always create time for ourselves, conscious time, to be less attached than more attached. We're physical beings living physical lives. But the more time we can give ourselves to kind of be less materialistic, less trapped by the here and the now, the more moments we give ourselves to kind of be spiritually free, prayer, study, selfless behavior, doing a mitzvah, whatever it is, the more trained we'll be to let that go. And that's a healthy thing, because at some point we'll have to let it go.
So I two thoughts that came to me as you were speaking. The first is that there are many, many stories of loved ones that pass on, and there's some communication with them that, particularly in the first few days after the passing, but you rarely hear a story beyond a year interaction or a communication or a feeling of the presence of a loved one, and I think that would explain that part.
Yep.
And the other part, though, is that you've said many times that the presence of a tzaddik can be felt even more strongly after the passing.
Yes.
Than when they are in life. And what comes to me is that the distinction from the feeling of the presence of a tzaddik many years later is perhaps because they were never attached to the body in real life, and hence when they communicate, it's because they were never attached to begin with, and hence the communication isn't bringing them down. They're able to sort of coexist with some interaction in the physical world.
Yeah, and it's, as explained to Tanya, I think you're spot on. That's exactly the point. It's a tzaddik, someone who's really a tzaddik, although there is some, at the end of the day, there is some material attachment, it's far less than the rest of us who are not tzaddikim. And therefore, the tzaddik was never really bound by the physical experience. And even when a tzaddik ate, the tzaddik didn't eat because the food looked good or tasted good. The tzaddik ate because that's what the body needed, and it was, you know, doing something for the body to keep the soul still plugged in. But it was never about the physical experience. It was always about the soulful experience. And so after the passing, the soul now is unencumbered by the body and can now revel in what it always was reveling in, but in an even greater way. And as Kabbalah says, not only is it now free to roam the spiritual dimensions, but it's even more present in the physical dimension as well, and it remains connected with those that were connected to it before.
Quick thoughts.
Sure.
Is there a cap on the amount of Jewish souls? And are souls more or less recycled, or
good questions?
The Garden of Eden?
Good question. Very good questions. So number one, there's theoretically a cap on souls, but souls can split. Which gets to your second question as well. And I'll tell you what I mean. The Jewish understanding of reincarnation is not that the soul is recycled in a like a one-to-one sense. Let me give you an example. Let's say the cup is the body and the soul is inside the body, right? Just to use this as an example. So we might say that what is reincarnation? The soul comes out of this body and another body comes in and it goes into that body. The same soul into a different container. I just did this to make it look like a different cup, but we all know that it was the same cup, right? So, right, it's in one body, swaps out, another body, swaps out, another body. Kabbalah says, Judaism says, that's not how it works. What happens? Every soul has a mission. In addition to its spiritual identity and its connection with God, it has a mission to do on earth, which is why it's here in the first place. And if it fulfills its mission, Then it goes up and goes to heaven, which we'll talk about soon, what that means. But if it doesn't finish its mission, it can't go on because it still has unfinished business. So what happens? It doesn't come down itself into another body, because why should it have to come down again if it already did some of its mission? So here's how it works. The example that's used in Kabbalah is when you take a candle, a flame, and light another candle, light another flame. So what happens? You have, right? Let's talk about candles. Chanukah candles. You take your shamash and you light a candle. So what happens? Before you had one candle that was lit, and now you have two candles that are lit. So I'll ask you a question. Is the first candle still lit? Yes. So you didn't diminish the first flame. You didn't diminish the first candle by lighting a second candle. Right? The first candle remains lit. All you've done is you've added a new candle. You've added a new flame. So this is like the difference between power and influence. Power, the more people you have involved, the more you divide power and the less power everyone has. So if one person calls all the shots and then you bring in a second person, well, now it's 50%. And if you bring in a third person, now each one shares the power 33%. So power divides. Influence multiplies, right? If somebody lives for something and they teach it to someone else, and now they live with that cause, with that purpose, so now instead of one person living with that purpose, you have two people living with that purpose. You haven't divided anything. You've only multiplied the influence or the cause. So power, by its definition, seeks less, seeks, right? Power seeks selfishness, right? You want to keep it hoarded for yourself. Influence seeks more. A soul doesn't divide itself. It multiplies itself after it passes on, if it has unfinished business. So when a soul passes on, if it still has items, things, tasks that it has not yet completed, what happens is from that soul is emanated forth another soul, a new soul. And that new derivative soul is what comes down into a new body to be considered to be a reincarnation of the first soul. This new soul is not a new soul from the original source of souls. It's a soul that's a branch off of what was a soul that came from a source. And all of us today are branches of branches of branches. So, right, it's like a road and a fork. And a fork, and a fork, and a fork, and a fork.
Family tree.
Huh?
Like a family tree.
Like a family tree, exactly. So we are, typically we don't have original souls today. So there are a finite number of original souls, but there are any number, it's anyone's guess as to how many derivative souls there are. And you say terms such as derivative soul or branch soul or whatever, it's not meant to be a negative. It's not a negative, it's just a reality. We're not necessarily original souls. Fine. What it means for us, though, is a few things. Number one, that a soul, after its time on earth, that soul goes through the process even if it's reincarnated. Right? The soul will go through the purgatory process and the heaven process or the heaven state, even if it needs to be reincarnated, because even if it needs to be reincarnated, it's not that same soul, it's a derivative soul. So that soul that was in that body goes on its journey even if it splinters off into another soul. Are you with me? Yes, does that make sense? Yes, no? Sort of? If it's the same soul that has to come back down again, so then there's no 11 months, there's no purgatory, there's no heaven, there's no eternal rest. There's nothing. Right? It's back down in the world. Right? It's schlepping around for another 80, 90, 120 years. So the understanding is, again, the original soul, the soul that was in the body, that goes through its process, its afterlife process. And if it needs to be reincarnated, a derivative soul is pulled off from it, and that has a new journey. But that soul that lived that lifespan is now on his journey into the afterlife.
One thing, the derivative soul that's reincarnated, could you say that what's derivative is that without the nefesh? Meaning, the nefesh is what is not coming back, but the higher levels are.
I'm not sure which level specifically. If we can divide the levels, and if I'm not sure, I don't want to speculate on that without looking at the sources to see if they discuss that of the five levels of the soul with reincarnation. Is it like an exact clone, if you will? You know, five for five and five. Or is it only the lower levels or only the higher levels? I'm not sure.
But the split, though, the image that comes to mind is it's not they're not like identical twins that are split off.
And right.
Right. It's an aspect of the soul.
It's an aspect. Exactly. It's an aspect. Not identical. It's an aspect of the soul that lived its life on earth that didn't finish its mission. So the part of it that didn't finish its mission is now rolled over into another soul, right? Like the candle, lighting another candle. Sorry?
Another body.
What?
No, the soul is rolled over into another soul, which then goes into another body. Right? It's like I used to be on Singular. Remember that Singular, the cell phone company? They had rollover minutes. So if you have like 1,000 minutes and you only use 750, you have 250, you have 1,250 the next month. So it's like if a soul has, you know, 1,000 items that it needs to do, and it doesn't do all of them, it does 750. So the 250 rolls over into a new soul. Right? So you have now those remaining 250 things that need to get done, they roll over. It's not exactly the same, obviously, right? But it rolls over into a derivative soul that now lives life on earth.
And when their body dies, what happens?
If it finishes the mission, then it heals itself as well as the soul that it came from. So imagine you have all these souls that are kind of, you know, scaffolded, like layered, that are waiting for like you and I to get the job done and to hit all the points, and then it boom, 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 boom. It can go back up maybe even many times to like repair everything. Now so that the souls merge, each one can maintain its own identity. But the souls find completion back in their source.
But when that happens,
yeah.
When the mission is complete, then there's no more incarnation of.
There's no more incarnation of that soul, and it goes back into the. Again, this is all anthropomorphic imagery, but it goes back into the form of Adam. Adam was the first human being, so Adam's soul, which looks like the form of a human being. Every soul has a place within Adam's silhouette, if you will. And when that soul is complete, its light shines and it's in its place.
So there's no need for the thought of hell then, since all souls, you know, the pieces move on and the other pieces come back.
Right. So the hell, again, the hell is understood as purgatory for the part of the soul or the aspect of the soul that's not coming back. For the soul that lived its life, right?
No terminal portal.
Correct. Oh, that's the key idea. Judaism does not talk about a hell that is a final destination. It's like, you know where we're going. It's going to be a while. It's not a while. Okay, 12 months, whatever. You could ask the other question, which is, how can you have a concept of time, 12 months, 11 months, any measure of time, after once you get beyond the parameters of this reality, right? In a spiritual reality, is there time? And if there's no time, so what are we talking about, 11 months, 12 months? We say Kaddish for 11 months and a day, not 12 months. Why? Because the soul is in a state of purification and rectification for that time. Really? The soul's on a clock and the time there matches here? I don't have a good answer for that one. I'm asking the question. I don't necessarily have a good answer for that. But it does say that we go by our time. We're here. We are here on earth, so we go by our time. And that's what it says. But yeah, hell is not considered to be a destination. It's not considered to be like, it's a stage to pass through. Every soul passes through in its cleansing process. And by the way, Kabbalah speaks of different types of hell, different types of purgatory. There's the one of heat. There's the one of cool, of cold. There's Gehenim Shel Eish, the purgatory of fire. But it's not the same, right? It's not the same. And Gehenim Shel Sheleg, and the purgatory of ice or snow. Hey, you can go to Palm, what's the in California? What's that? Palm Springs. Or you can go to
Death Valley.
Death Valley is hot also, right?
Oh, I thought.
Is Death Valley hot? Yeah.
Hot.
Death Valley. So you go to Death Valley or Palm Springs. Or you can go to, give me a cold, snowy place.
Chicago.
Chicago, right? What is it?
Alaska.
So you pick your purgatory, right? No. So it says that if our attachment, if we got too attached to the passions of materialism, so you have to fight fire with fire. So to purge it, it needs heat to purge. If it went in with fire and passion, it's got to come out with fire and passion. If our condition of material, I don't know, attachment was that we became indifferent to spiritual things, like, not so interested. To get the soul back in, so we became cold to spirituality, so we have to fight that with a cold Gehenna, a cold purgatory. So this is Telluride, this is Aspen, this is Anchorage. What's the place that you said?
Alaska. It's a windblown island.
Yes. Yes. So we need the cold to fight the cold and the heat to fight the heat. There's also, Kabbalah speaks of the old slingshot, Kafakela. You know about, you've heard about this? The slingshot. It says two souls stand, again, it's not literal. Two souls stand on opposite ends of the universe and they take a slingshot and they sling the soul from one end to the other. And you're thinking, this is what I need now. This is what I need, a big slingshot hurtling through the air. Imagine a soul. Get me off of this. Wearing like aviator goggles or something. It's not literal. What it means is, you know how sometimes if you want to dust off something, you kind of like throw it in the air and catch it, and when you catch it, it kind of like the dust releases a little bit? So sometimes you have to like shake out the soul a little bit. Like shake off the dust. It's a little bit attached to some physical stuff. So you have to like, sometimes if you have a rug, you know, you hold it outside, you take a stick. I'm not saying that there's the exact same thing in Kabbalah, doesn't speak of the old stick and the rug, you know. I don't want to create a new purgatory experience. But in a similar way, you have to sometimes shake it out. Anyway, every soul needs this divestment process, and each soul has its own formula. But Gehinnom, purgatory, is not a destination. It's a process through which the soul is now ready to experience heaven. So now you might be asking, great, so what's heaven? I'm glad you asked. Heaven, stated simply, is a state of being where the soul is at perfect rest and peace with itself and its purpose. Heaven is a state of ultimate bliss. Heaven is a state of the ultimate ease, not dis-ease with itself, but rather ease with itself. It's comfortable, it's secure, and it's happy. If you were a soul, and you are a soul, your soul and a body. But if, imagine a pure soul, what would a pure soul want more than anything else?
To be reabsorbed into the source.
To be reabsorbed within the source, to feel the source, to know the source, to love the source, to be one with the source. It just wants source. It wants God. That's all it wants. It doesn't want a bigger cloud for itself, you know, more robust wings to fly ever higher. It's not about self. It's about wanting to just be part of and to know and to realize. And so Kabbalah teaches that this is the ultimate state of the soul. The ultimate state of the soul is where the soul is once more at peace with itself and with its source, with God. And so what does the soul do? What do souls do in heaven? Like, what are they doing all this time? Imagine Moses' soul passed away 3,300 years ago. Abraham's soul, Adam's soul, thousands of years. What are these souls doing? Right? They have a day job. What are they doing?
They eat soul food.
They eat soul food. Exactly. What are they doing, these souls? All day, every day, for eternity. What are they doing? You know what they're doing? They're connecting and enjoying and basking in divine radiance. You know, one of the greatest pleasures that human beings have is understanding, figuring things out. How enjoyable is it to have a puzzle that you can't figure out, and then you got it? Oh, it's so satisfying. It feels good to get something. After it leaves the body, and after it divests itself from all my favorite restaurant, and my favorite shirt, and my favorite, all right, it was nice while it lasted, let's move on, right? It's nice, you can't take it with you, right? Can't take your shirt with you to heaven. So you gotta let it go, gotta let it go. So after the soul lets it go, what's the greatest joy? For the soul to feel God, to know God, to be one with God, right? That's its greatest joy. Hey guys, go around the other way, please. We're almost done. So when the soul is in that state of connection, it's at peace and it's in a state of bliss and ecstasy and perfection. That's all the soul wants and that's all the soul has. And so, when we think about it, when we think about heaven, it's so easy to create heaven in our image. Like, what would be the best day for you today? Right? A good meal, a good place to rest, a hobby that you enjoy. So heaven is like all of that times, you know, a million. But that's like the coach driver who wanted for heaven a smooth road, good horses, and a comfortable carriage. That's not heaven. That's degrading heaven. That's like, that's embarrassing for that coach driver. All eternity on a horse and buggy? Are you kidding me? That's it? That's the highest you can think. That's your heaven. Heaven is not the best day that we can have now times a million. Heaven is a completely different reality, a spiritual reality, a reality of feeling one with God. It's a reality merging with the language that we've been discussing the last few weeks. It's a reality in which the dichotomy of chesed and gevura, of havaya and elokim, that dichotomy dissolves. What do I mean? We live in a world in which everything appears through a filter. We don't see God. We see everything, divine light, through a material lens. But we know, because we have Torah and Kabbalah and we have tzaddikim, like we said last week, we know that there's another reality, a reality where there's pure light beyond the filter, pure unfiltered light of truth. What is heaven? Heaven is where the soul that spent time on earth, heaven is where that split, the divide between chesed and gvura, havaya, elokim, limitation and no limitation, it's where that boundary, that border, that dichotomy absolutely dissolves. And the soul sees the truth. It sees that God is everything. God is both the infinite and the finite. God is the light and the light passing through the filter. And it sees itself as part of that oneness. And in that state, it sees ultimate truth. All the questions of life and all the mysteries of life are answered. And it sees itself as part of something that is absolutely incredible. And so this vision and awareness is not possible for a soul on earth in a body. Moses asked God, can I see your face? And God said, no one can see my face and live. You can see my face and not live, but you can't see my face and live. Those two are not compatible. Those are incompatible. If you want to see my face, you can in the afterlife. Heaven is where we see the face of God. Heaven is where heaven is where a soul that was once attached to a body is where a soul now can see the perfect truth, can see God unfiltered, and also how God is the filter that it experienced. It's the ultimate aha moment. You mean all of that stuff was really you? Yeah, it was. It's like when you get the riddle and you see how all the elements of the riddle, this is the solution. It's like, it feels so good to get a puzzle right? Right? You get the solution to a puzzle and suddenly it all makes sense. That's part. We can't do justice to it, but that's part of the bliss of the soul in heaven. It sees the truth. It's part of the truth. It's aware of truth. The puzzles are solved. It sees not only the light, the pure light, but it sees the light passing through the filter as well on its way down to earth. It sees both the unlimited and the limitation, both the chesed and the gvura. It sees it all, and it's part of all. A soul on earth can't see it and live. We only see through the filter, and we know about these things. We don't see it. We can talk about it, and we can imagine it, but we don't see it. A soul unencumbered by a body after purgatory can experience it. It's different. I can read about Aspen, and I can read, I can watch videos and read and study and tour guides and from today to tomorrow. But it's different to when I go to Aspen, theoretically, and actually hit the slopes. That's something far different than just reading about it. Today, you and I can study. We can learn about the light beyond. We can learn about the souls unencumbered. We can learn about that experience, that bliss. As the dichotomy dissolves, we can talk about it, and we can feel excited about it, and we can imagine it. But we're still at home, not in Aspen. Not that heaven is Aspen, but maybe it is. I don't know. I've never been there. The point is, and there's Chabad and Aspen, so maybe it's not too far from heaven. The point is that you and I today, in a body, even Moses was told, you're not going to see it. You're not going to experience it for yourself. You will at some point, but not right now with a body. Can't. It doesn't work. A body needs the filter. If you take away the filter, if you experience without the filter, the body can't exist. So if you have a body still, you still have a filter. Once the soul finishes, then it can have that higher experience. And this is the mystery of life. The cycle of life is that the soul comes into a body and it experiences a reality through this massive filter where all it knows is light that's already passed through some filter to diminish and recolor and frame that light. That's all we know. But then we have pockets of light that we can almost imagine. We can almost see. We study Torah. We meet someone incredible. We meet a tzaddik. And pockets of light filter through, perhaps. Cracks of light filter through. And maybe we have an experience that uplifts us. But the pure experience of that light happens in the afterlife. Lest you think that therefore Judaism is all about getting to heaven, you should know that sometimes life is not about the light. Sometimes the goal is not about getting to the light. It's about living with purpose. And in fact, as I mentioned before, the soul doesn't want to come down into the body, but once it's here, it doesn't want to leave. And I mentioned before, it's because we became materially attached. And the truth is, it's not only that. It's also because the soul, having spent time on earth, recognizes that it can only accomplish here on earth. In heaven, no matter all of the truth that it sees, and it's amazing, and it feels tremendous for the soul, and it's so enjoyable, and as we'll discuss next week, we'll do inside next week, it studies, and it learns, and it sees, and it experiences, and it's amazing. Notwithstanding all that, despite all that, it can't do. It can't feed a hungry stomach, and it can't soothe an aching heart, and it can't be a shoulder for someone to cry on. It can't do that in heaven. And therefore, there's something magical about what we do in the here and now. Next week, we'll talk about a little bit more about that. We'll talk about more about inside what heaven looks like vis-a-vis what we study in heaven. And we'll also look at how what we do now forms the experience of heaven that we're going to have then. Thank you very much for joining me this morning for Kabbalah and Coffee.